I could while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain. I would dance and be merry, life would be a ding-a-dairy if I only had a brain.
Once upon a time, in a galaxy far, far, well, it was actually this galaxy, but anyway, there was once this brain, a very special truth-seeking brain.
I just gotta know the truth.
One day, this truth-seeking brain got super-duper confused because there were so many claims to truth all around him, it just didn't make any fetching sense.
I just gotta know the truth.
So one night, as this truth-seeking brain was reading some words written by one of his heroes, he realized that, hey, there's a better way to figure out the one true truth.
I just gotta know the truth.
You know, the one truth that's way, way better than all the other truths, because it's the only truth and all the other truths just, well, they just aren't.
You are pathetic and weak!
So he followed the instructions from his hero, and he went into a secluded place, and he learned firsthand that pretty much everyone else was wrong. I mean, dead wrong. Like, totally and completely, totally dead wrong. Now, sure, maybe there were other truth-seeking brains out there, brains who really, really wanted to know the truth, like him.
I just gotta know the truth.
I just gotta know the truth.
We all just gotta know the truth.
Now, if so, they would eventually join him and form some kind of special elite community of truth-seeking brains, an island among all of the non-truth-seeking brains out there. You know, those brains that just seek after beauty or fun or any kind of community that will accept them, really, no matter how totally stupid and lame that community might be. And this truth-seeking brain realized that he was just a little bit more interested in actual truth than all those other dumbass brains. And that made him feel really super good. And it helped him to realize that anything he was attracted to was actually, in fact, truth. Just by nature of his very truth-seeking brain. And ditto for all the other truth-seeking brains in his circle. And they all lived happily ever after. Well, okay, maybe not totally happy. Maybe not in all cases, you know, like maybe at a funeral, they were actually the only ones that were really, truly sad because they were mourning the death of a friend or a loved one who, you know, well, the truth is that they're never, ever going to see them again. And sure, maybe the non-truth-seeking brains there might find some form of happiness in the delusion that they actually will see the dead person again. But come on, truth-seeking brains, they just can't be comforted by delusion. But anyway, this guy was happy with his truth-seeking brain, so let's just leave it at that. The end.
This is Infants on Thrones. Philosophies of men mingled with humans. We are the core.
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I'm Glenn Ostlund, and today, well, liberal Mormons, right? We've had this conversation before, right? The mental gymnastics of accepting the best parts of your religion and rejecting the worst parts and just, how would you say it, just choosing to believe? You know, if belief is actually really a choice. But so why do some people leave the Mormon Church and some people stay? And especially, why do those people stay that know all the problems? You know, what's going on there? Is it because some people are just wired to have more truth-seeking brains? Well, this is probably the central question in today's episode, which is really just a random recorded conversation between myself and Randy and Jake. You know, we didn't have any plans for this conversation. I kind of hit record in the middle of us talking, and, you know, you'll probably hear this, but, you know, this is essentially what came out of it. So hopefully, all of you who are listening have, let's listen to three guys just talk out of their asses seeking brains, because you're about to be hit square in the amygdala right now.
So much of this.
It would hurt too much.
I think that's the main like tenet of
the pastoral apologetics, like liberal Mormon type thing. So have you guys read the Adam Miller post on By Common Consent? He put it up recently and it pinged around a bunch of places. But basically it was like I think the post title was Letter to a CES Student or something like that. You know, so it was something about the idea was, you know, you got something good in Mormonism and it feels true and it's, and you know, you're here and there are good things about it. So just stick around and ignore the stuff you don't like. And I feel like that's liberal Mormonism really buys into the sunk cost idea implicitly, because it's, the idea is you've already found something good and just work with what you have and lift, you know, lift where you stand. And
yeah, and they because, love to use the analogy, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I'm yes, like, it's all bathwater.
It's all bath.
Well, right. And you know, this is something, you know, Andrew, what's his name? George, Wheaton Tares.
Spriggs.
Yeah. I mean, he and I going back several years, you know, not that we don't talk that often, but this idea about whether or not belief is a choice, you know, and I for the longest time have been on the fence or on the side of that yeah, it is a choice. I don't know, because like as I'm listening to what you're saying, Randy, and what you're saying, Jake, I'm thinking if you could choose. Like I like either of you guys, if you could say if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Yeah, Mormonism works for me in my life. I like it. Then you still would, but it got to a point where you couldn't put the toothpaste back in the tube. You couldn't like just force yourself to ignore the stuff that bugs you and just go on, right? Like so, yeah. I don't know exactly where I come down on it now, but because I do believe that there's a choice in belief and to a certain extent, but I don't know.
I think that people, there are people that are just predisposed to buy into this a religious type ideology, and there are people that just aren't. And like, but they're in my family. My sisters, I have two sisters-in-law who have never really been interested in the church at any point. It never fit for them. It never worked for them. They never really bought into.
But they were lifelong members.
Lifelong members, yeah. Born in the church, but it never, ever, ever sunk in at any level. Right. And I don't think – I mean, if they lived a million lifetimes, I don't think it ever would. And so, you know, I just think that there are some people that are predisposed to belief and people that are not. And the fact – and the idea that you're eternally punished or rewarded based on that predisposition, that's something that made the plan of salvation fall apart for me.
Well, okay, but like if you go to your sister-in-law as an example, they're not bought into the belief, but are they bought into the culture? I mean, is it something that they're like, I'm not going to rock it. It is what it is, and I'm just going to go with it. I'm not going to make waves.
No, they didn't buy into the culture at all either. So they were outsiders in every way.
They don't attend.
No.
And so your brothers who are married to these women, are they active or are they out?
Well, it's not my brothers. It's my wife's sisters.
Oh, your wife's
so
sisters.
So one of them, gotcha, married a non-member. The other one is married. But it's
– And they are products of a very liberal Mormon family, household.
Yeah, but it's weird because my wife's family, her brothers are all very stalwart, but her sisters – The women in the family are the ones that are kind of on the outside, which,
you know,
I think inverts it. Why?
Feminism.
Yeah, that might be it. Like, honestly, I think that guy that sent out that wrote the article that we were talking about, that you sent around earlier about how Democrats can't be good Mormons.
Oh, that bishop.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I think that there's definitely a very strong correlation between political liberalism and your probability of leaving the church.
Sometimes the Mormon culture is a bad fit just for somebody's disposition. You know, they're not a conformist. And so to me, that's more of like there's a social, bad fit there. But as far as believing the doctrine, the theology, at least as it's presented in Mormonism 2014, I couldn't choose to believe. I just could not. And I was talking to my brother, Jimmy, and his brilliant daughter when we were driving to a funeral. when I was in Utah the other weekend, and I was telling them, I still want to do this podcast on Mormon funerals. They freaked me out. And one of the things that my niece brought up was there's different people have different levels, or they prioritize things that are important to them in their head. And one of the things that gets prioritized is really finding the truth. And not everybody really puts that as a high priority.
Yeah, but see, I do have a problem with that, Randy. Sorry, I always seem to have a problem with something. But because when I think about believers, they really do think that they've cornered the market on truth. So I don't think it's that they're not interested in finding out about truth. They think they've already got it. And it's important to them, and they don't want to deviate from it, because they've been conditioned to think that if you look outside, you're going to be fed lies and you'll be deceived, and they want
the
truth.
Well, yeah, because that's all part of the scam, conditioning. But some people, if the level of really wanting to know the truth and is high enough, and I think that's what happened to pretty much all of us. That happened with Tom. Like he learned something, and he just had to get to the bottom of it, and he went down a rabbit hole.
I don't know.
The truth was really important to him. And then the same thing, someone else will hear the exact same thing, and it's something that they suffer cog dis, and they push it away, and they go on with their happy lives. I just don't want to know. How many times have I heard people say, I know you've learned all this stuff. I don't even want to know. I don't want to know.
But the thing is, I think that that's not them not wanting to know the truth. I think that what they're doing is they're prioritizing the quote-unquote spiritual side of the church over its empirical – over some sort of empirical lens and looking at it. Like it's not that they don't – I kind of agree with Glenn. I don't think that they don't want to know the truth. They just think that following an empirical truth, if that undermines the spiritual truth that they've found – then it's not worth pursuing.
Yeah, but if you
– I think it's just a different definition of what you're prioritizing.
If you're not even interested in like stepping outside of your house because you think this is the only place I could be and I'm never going to leave this house, that's because you care about the truth, because your truth is that your house is the one place that you have to be. That you don't care about truth. You care about being comfortable.
Well,
you care about having peace.
You define truth differently.
Yeah, I don't know. Would you say that Brian Dalton's when he wouldn't engage Dan Witherspoon in saying that Nephi was a real person, when he wouldn't meet him halfway in allowing that possibility, was he not interested in pursuing truth?
Yeah,
seems like
he's written wrote a whole bunch. He told me his memoirs of all of his research. He's already been there. he has.
I know, but the believer
left the religion.
But the believers feel that way too. They feel like I've been there. I've tasted of the fruit, and I'm not going to leave the tree because this is truth. They're defining it by that internal subjective experience.
No, they've been fed a truth. They didn't find any truth out on their own. They've been fed a truth, and they've stuck with it.
But you've been fed a truth too. You just read other people's other people's accounts and other people's research, and then drew your. I mean, I didn't study the Mayans, but I read other people's research on studying the Mayans. Have I been fed that?
Well, now you're gonna get rid of all assumptions. Like, there's no way to know.
No, but
anything.
I think it's just like to me, my reaction against it is and most of the times when I react this way about it, it just seems like we're being unfair and like almost setting up a straw man that believers don't care about truth. Ex-Mormons who have left, we care about truth, man. We care about truth. They don't. And I don't like that. I don't agree.
I don't agree with you. So
that's cool, man.
I think there's a certain kind of brain, a certain kind of disposition. and I was listening yesterday to how they can predict who's going to be Republican and who's going to be Democrat, who's going to be liberal, who's going to be conservative. There's certain kind of brains, like people that have a strong aversion to change. They like the comfortableness of what's familiar.
So how is this not like Hitler kind of superior race kind of rhetoric where,
like,
where
eugenics,
you're like,
type thing.
Yeah,
almost.
You're like, ex-Mormons have better brains. They just have fundamentally superior brains.
You guys
than
are
Mormons.
Throwing in all of these fucking loaded terms that I and straw manning my argument.
I could while away the hours conferring with the flowers.
Yeah, okay, yeah, we are. But go ahead.
So certain kinds of brains are gonna lean in certain directions, and that'll put them in certain kind of circles that will make them lean even further into that direction. And you know, I don't feel superior because I don't believe, but I obviously feel like I had the kind of disposition and brain where, God damn it, I'm not going to just take what I've been fed from birth and say, you know, that's it, and I'm not going to challenge it. And I thought I challenged it, but it was a trick by the church. And once internet came out, you know, I think we've had a big swelling of people leaving the church because the church could no longer control the information. Once that happened, then you start seeing people who react in two different ways. They retrench, or they become disillusioned and angry because, you know, they, at some point they're like, they prioritize finding out the truth over the comfortable reality that they existed in for so long. And it's, everyone explains it as a painful experience, or at least most people I've ever heard talk about it.
So what do you
think? It doesn't make you better, it just makes you different.
So what do you think about people who leave their current religion to join Mormonism? Are they not interested in finding truth? Or are they interested in finding truth? I mean, if interest in finding truth is just a disposition to go outside your comfort zone, then those are the most truth-seeking people out there.
Yeah, but Mormonism isn't true. So they found something. And, there's lots of reasons why people join the church. The missionary was good-looking. All of them are not told everything. All of them are told a fraction of 1% of what Mormonism really is.
So can I ask you a question? Does the Mormon church make its believing members feel special?
Of course.
And do they want to feel special?
Yeah, because that's very comfortable and warm.
So how is that not a version of truth? Or how is that not an acceptable truth?
Because it's fucking false, dude. It's objectively false.
Okay. I think that's what you hit on there. Is I wouldn't say that they're not interested in finding truth, but I would definitely say that they're not empiricists. And they do not – I mean I would say that a believing Mormon does not approach or view Mormonism from an empirical standpoint.
They don't view anything but Mormonism. I mean they stay within a box that's safe, and they're told if they leave the box –
one of my brothers in law is MD PhD. He's a geneticist, and he works at the University of Washington med school and in a hospital near there. So I mean, this guy is a scientist with a capital S. I mean, he's as steeped into an empirical field as you could possibly be. But he's also a stalwart believing Mormon that believes in the Book of Mormon literally. So I wouldn't say that all he views
that's,
Mormonism.
That's called compartmentalization. He has cow that he doesn't want to know. Like, he is just comfortable with it. It works for him. Because what you guys are doing is equivocating the word truth. Like, you're saying, this is my truth. No, there are objective truths.
I didn't phrase my example very well. So let me try and rephrase it. If the missionaries meet a convert, and the missionaries say, if you read Moroni 3:5, or more, what is the Moroni's promise? Mormon
chapter 10,
no, Moroni 10:3.
Okay, you read this scripture, you pray about it, you're going to feel this feeling, and the investigator does it, and they do feel that feeling. Then are you saying that the missionaries lied to them, or is that truth? They say it's true. It's true that if you pray about this, you'll feel it. Now, when you really start looking at it, you can explain different reasons why they felt it than the Holy Ghost and the God. So you know, truth there is debatable. But that truth in the moment, if you do this, you pray about it, you're going to feel it, and they do. How is that not
truth.
So when a
how is that not truth seeking at least?
Well,
I'm just pushing against.
It may be truth seeking in that moment, but it's not like a pervasive, desire to. Because then you go through your whole life, especially in the age of the internet, you're going to come across disconfirming evidence, and if you just won't even entertain it, you won't even go there. You completely shut it out of your life, and you build a wall around yourself after you're in. I mean, people join the church for lots of reasons. So he had a feeling. Well, the missionaries manipulated him in that feeling. It's like, okay, so
when a con man themselves because they really wanted to feel it really bad. You know,
when a con man, cons someone. And they really feel like this was a legit guy. Is that
a con man knows that he's conning?
The missionary is an extension of the con men.
The missionaries are just as conned as the people that they're conning. But they believe that what they believe is truth, and they're presenting it as truth. And they set up these little tests of truth. If you read this is going to happen. And there's all these things built in that if it doesn't happen, then you just keep praying. Keep praying because, the formula is right there in Moroni's promise. You know, you've got to have nothing doubting. So if it doesn't happen, I must have had something doubting. I'd try it again without any doubting, without any doubting. Oh, without any doubting means I believe it. Oh, I believe it. I believe it. You know, but it's still, you can't compare them to con men that are out doing this con because they don't know they're doing it. They are pursuing truth and they're trying to spread truth.
Well, I was talking to John DeLynn the other day about, again, I was talking about the funeral podcast I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And he said, because I was wondering, is it more healthy to believe in the church and the afterlife when you're mourning, or are you losing something when you're not facing the real truth that person is gone and they're not coming back and you're not going to see him again? And he says, well, there is a thing in psychology that is true. Ignorance truly is bliss. So I think people that have... I think there are certain people. I'm not going to say there's two kinds of people because it's probably a continuum. But people are more on one side. The cognitive dissonance that they feel is so painful that they're just never going to question. And then there's people on the other side that can live, can deal with some cognitive dissonance, and if they have to. If they have to find out a truth that's painful, they're willing to do it because, damn it, the truth, they have to know the truth. They just have to know how the trick is done. How did that magician do that trick? I have to know. Other people are like, it's cool. I like the mystique of it. I think there's two kinds of brains, and I'm not saying one's superior than the other. You know what I'm saying? I said it was a continuum earlier.
Okay.
It's a propensity. To go into places that are uncomfortable, to be a little bit more adventurous.
No, but
intellectually,
it's not about being adventurous or being comfortable or uncomfortable. Because I've known people that were atheists that converted to Mormonism. Like I know people that have gone that way as well. It's not just a propensity to be uncomfortable. It's just, do you prioritize an empirical worldview over a non-empirical worldview? And if you define truth that way, then, as you pursue the truth claims of the church, you'll probably end up leaving. But if you don't, then you can become an apologist and do all these mental gymnastics because you're prioritizing the spiritual evidences over the empirical evidences or disevidences, whatever you want to call it, of these truth claims.
I want to ask a question, and I want you guys to know this is a completely sincere question. I'm a little worried I'm going to get beat up by asking it, okay, because it falls into tropes. But Randy, you keep talking about truth, and Jake, you're talking about empiricism. You take the example of the funeral, and you're asking, why don't these people recognize the truth that they will never see their loved one again? you cannot empirically prove that to be true. You're talking about probabilities. And there's times where you invoke probability and times where you invoke truth. But, you know, the truth is that it is incredibly highly improbable that, there is a life after death. But you know you can't prove it. But then it's said in such, like, absolute terms that I take issue with it. I don't even know if there's a question in there. It's just I'm just describing my reaction as I'm listening to these things.
But, Jake, you said there's people that are more empiricists than people that aren't. But empiricism has only been around for like 150 years, maybe a few hundred years if you go back to the 1600s. But our brains are pretty much the same as 12,000. Let me finish the question. I didn't even make an assertion.
Okay.
So our brains are pretty much the same as they've been for the last, 40, 50, 60,000 years. We haven't evolved that much. We're not any smarter than ancient Egyptians. But once empiricism came, wouldn't you have to concede that there then were certain kind of brains that were more drawn to this new tool and other brains who were more wary of it?
How can you say that empiricism – have you ever heard of Euclidean geometry? That was invented by the ancient Greeks. Like, how can you say that empiricism is – I mean, sure, as a formal philosophy, empiricism hasn't been around that long. But empiricism,
sure, there's some
looking ancient for the objective truth and finding these things that are objectively true and proving them by experimentation or by in mathematics just by theorems and axioms. Like, that's been around since the Babylonians. It's been around as long as there's been systems of writing and geometry was created and algebra so that people could have financial systems and banking systems.
Yeah, I mean, but that, in the early days, it wasn't that available to the masses. It was the elite. But even you're going back now is 6,000 years? And our brains have pretty much been the same for tens of thousands of years.
Oh, right. Yeah, there's been
So what I'm saying is there are, you kind of made my argument for me. There's different kinds of brains that'll be drawn to empirical truth or truth that's comfortable.
What I'm pushing back against is truth that's comfortable. I mean, I think that empirical truth and non-empirical truth are two different things. And by the way, like, I agree with you. Like, I think that I am an empiricist, and I think that empiricism is better than non-empirical ways of looking at the world and approaching the world. I think empiricism is a superior ideology, and it's a superior frame of mind through which we can approach the world, because that's what's brought us all of the great technological advances and jumps in philosophy. And
so, Jake, my question then from my earlier statement is, can you be an empiricist if you make strident claims that you cannot prove empirically?
What?
There's no afterlife or something like that.
Like, can you truly be an empiricist if you're putting all of your eggs in this basket that you cannot validate?
All your eggs in this basket?
There is no afterlife. The truth is that there is no afterlife.
I don't know that there is no afterlife.
Then how is that the truth?
Because it's not knowable. It's an unknowable proposition.
Truth is that these people will never see each other again.
What you do is you have to face the likelihood, because you
invoke probability.
But you're like putting this like huge.
No, I'm just
overstatement.
I'm
of,
not.
Of my
I'm
position.
I'm restating what you said. I'm not overstating it, and I'm asking if you can be an empiricist and make claims like that cannot be empirically proven.
I don't make absolute claims about the afterlife, facing the real truth that person is gone and they're not coming back. You said
that the truth is that they're not going to see each other again.
I should have said the likelihood.
There's no evidence that any part of you survives death.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you say likelihood or probability or anything like that, then I don't have a problem.
Okay. Well, then I just got to be cleaner with my language.
Okay.
But, you know, going to a funeral now is such a painful thing for me. If it's somebody that I love and know, obviously know, yeah. I love them. You know, when I went to my cousin's wedding, her funeral, she died of cancer, melanoma, leaving a 7, a 5, and a 3-year-old girl and her young husband. And I went to the funeral and I am a train wreck because I'm just so sad. And then I see the girls kiss their mom's corpse goodbye for the last time. They shut the lid and I lose it even more. And I'm the only one in the room that's just bawling uncontrollably. And then I turned to my dad who's standing next to me, stoic. My dad lost his mom when he was 6. If anyone should have seen the scene and been like completely punched in the gut, it should have been my dad. It's just completely stoic. And then it was almost like a party. And everyone was like, they all felt sorry for me. And then that was the time that my cousin wrote that letter that was in the other podcast comparing me to the convict.
Oh, with Keith? That you've lost your light.
I've lost my right, light and my countenance, but I'll always be welcome. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that. But there's like I could not at that point choose to believe that she was going to see her kids again. That's what made it so sad, because I don't think it's likely.
Right.
I think it's very unlikely that, and I think it's absolutely. I'm going to go absolute on the Mormon heaven. I know that doesn't exist. A heaven of some sort, or some afterlife of some sort. I can't make that strong of a statement. But there's no choice there, because if I wanted to not feel so much pain, couldn't I just snap my fingers and choose to then believe that it is true that she'll see her kids after? You know, in the afterlife, I don't think it's a choice.
Yeah, and it may be a series of choices, and like a process of choices, not just like one single choice. That when you're there in the moment, you can go, oh, "I'm going to choose something else." You know, but many choices that have brought you to that place where you do.
Yeah, many choices enticed by the adversary led up to the wretch that I was at that funeral.
Yeah, I guess it could go either way.
Here's an interesting study that was done recently. They showed the group of people disgusting images, like just really gross things, like vomit, you know, on running down the face of another person that got vomited on, you know, that kind of shit, like really gross stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to predict with 95% accuracy by the brain scans of the people as they were watching which ones were Republican and which ones were Democrat. 95%. And guess who, which party of people have the strongest aversion to and disgust in their brain when watching these images?
The Democrats.
Nope, Republicans.
Really?
Yep.
Why?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know that you can really answer it, but conservative, you know, once you think that people that really have strong disgust centers, like, you know, think of people that can't get over how disgusting gay sex is, to just let that go and just really and look at the issue beyond their emotions.
Maybe. Yeah, I was thinking from the other end, the people that are more empathetic of the suffering of others.
Well, this wasn't like, you know, someone getting their arm chopped off. It wasn't pain. Like, there was no pain. It was just really disgusting stuff.
If I saw somebody with vomit running down their face, I'd feel bad for them. That was the example you gave. So I mean, that's why I answered what I did.
But, yeah, it wasn't like a suffering video. It wasn't faces of death or scenes of torture. That I think that would be a totally different experiment. It's seeing, like, you know, some really creamy shit coming out of somebody's ass kind of stuff.
You really, really wanted to go there, didn't you?
Yeah, because that was there was just a lull in the conversation. He's like, hey, guess what?
Yeah.
I just think that's interesting because they went inside the brain and they found, you know, which ones they were able to predict which ones were conservative. And let's just take the parties out of it. Which ones lean towards a conservative worldview and which ones lean towards a liberal worldview. And that doesn't correlate. That doesn't, like, that's not completely applicable to what we've been talking about. But I think that's interesting.
So we got a response today from our on the survey that's still around. Male, 40 to 49. He's active, semi-believing. He didn't really give us any indication on who he is other than that. He said, IoT are hilarious. The church is kind of a crock, but I'm a firm Jesus believer. It sounds like Wes Cothers to me, but I don't know. It's interesting to me how much more you all have become militant atheists over the years. It sometimes feels like you're chasing each other to be more shocking. Cheers. So I think when you just gave the creamy shit coming out of the ass, you validated.
Yeah, that's, no, I bet.
I was just telling you about a study, man.
Yeah, you weren't just.
I was trying to make a differentiation, but you were talking. You had the misunderstanding that it was like people videos of people suffering. Yes. Bad things happen to people. It was disgusting images.
Right. I think that some people's brains are just more developed towards wanting to shock other people. That's what I think.
That would be just a personality trait,
probably.
I'd rather clean all the bathrooms in Grand Central Station with my tongue than spend one more minute with you.
Can you be an empiricist and make absolute claims about things that you can't back up? That you can't prove?
Well, nobody's like, I don't know. There's a limit to the way that people internalize empiricism. I mean, nobody's purely empirical.
Oh, and you can't be purely empirical. You wouldn't be able to function as a human being.
Right.
But you have to use your heuristics every day.
Right. And you make choices in the things that you say and the way that you express it. And whether you're going to be completely stridently absolutist or you're going to give a little wiggle room.
No, but when it comes to, I think what Jake's point was, is when it comes to the really big, important questions, you know, empiricism has delivered the goods. It has improved civil rights and the way humans treat each other, at least in the enlightened, developed countries. And so it's more of a big question thing versus your daily getting around and interacting in social groups, you know?
Well, yeah. Sure, when you
make positive claims about things that you can't support, isn't that getting into the realm of faith?
Oh my God, you're such a straw manner tonight.
I'd unravel every riddle for any individual.
What is straw manish about that, Randy?
You keep saying that I make absolute claims about things I don't know.
No, you're the one that's a person making it all personal. He's just saying Glenn, you just meant like the general right?
They're not really good empiricists because you're supposed to withhold judgment. Until the evidence becomes, overwhelming.
Well, I don't know.
When we communicate, we don't know. I mean, we use rhetoric all the time. We use hyperbole, Bob, superlative disorder. We all fall into those traps. When it comes down to it, if somebody is saying, and they stick to it, even when somebody, you know, says, are you sure you're going to go that far? Somebody says, absolutely, I know that there's no life after death. Then they're not a good empiricist because there's no way.
All right. I would say this. I think we're kind of conflating empiricism with naturalism, which are two. I mean, they're very related to each other. But naturalism is the philosophy where everything that you see and everything you observed can be explained by normal natural phenomena. And empiricism is you withhold judgment until a hypothesis is proved or disproved. And so
quantifiably, right?
Right. In some sort of experimental, like repeatable,
right?
Yeah, quantifiable. I guess it would be the best way of saying it. So in a quantifiable way. And so I mean, because according to the way that you just defined empiricism, Randy, then you should – I mean, someone could say, I believe in an afterlife until – and I will remain – but I'll set my null hypothesis according to some sort of afterlife, and then I'll wait for the evidence to disprove that.
No, I mean, because they're making a positive claim. There's nothing after this life. Is just that's the true null hypothesis, I think, and then like, okay, let's see the evidence, you know, and the evidence, in my opinion, isn't compelling, but it's not conclusive. There's nothing out there. I mean,
well, I mean, the null hypothesis is people buy into null too much.
What is null hypothesis? I mean, you've talked about it a lot. I don't really know. I've never heard a definition of it.
The null hypothesis is the default position you're going to take, and that must be disproved in whatever experiment you're about to conduct.
Okay.
And so that a lot of people think that that means that you have to assume that nothing is happening, but that's not the case. There are null hypotheses. There are null hypotheses that are actually positive intrinsically, but they're the null hypothesis for whatever you're trying to measure. Like there, if you want to see if a distribution is a certain shape, a lot of times those null hypotheses are, hey, it is this shape until proven otherwise. And so null hypothesis is all relative to whatever you're trying to prove or disprove. So if you, that's why I'm saying you have to be if you're a naturalist empiricist, then your null hypothesis is always nothing supernatural, something that's observable in the natural world.
Right.
That's your null hypothesis. And then if you're the empiricist part of that is, and I'm waiting for evidence to overturn that. Or evidence would have to be compelling enough for me to change that.
So can you think of what is a non-naturalist, a spiritualist? I mean, what would you call that? That there are empiricists who are not naturalists?
Yeah, there could be people who act or in a lot of ways adopt an empirical mindset, but are
they accept not metaphysics?
They're not right, but they accept metaphysics. Yeah, exactly, and that's why. I mean, there's a lot of people that are scientists in very rigorous empirical fields that you know are Mormon or whatever, you know, and maintain that the Book of Mormon is a historical record, and they're doing all these mental gymnastics and crazy apologetics, and that's because they're not naturalists per se, but they are trying to be or at least maintain the facade of empiricism. So.
Yeah. But not all null hypotheses are created equal, right?
Right, I mean, right, absolutely.
If I had a null hypothesis that there's an invisible purple unicorn in my garage, that's not a very good null hypothesis,
right?
And it can't be disproved because it's invisible.
Yeah, and the and for example, when the Challenger exploded, the reason that that happened is because the way that the null hypothesis was set up for how strong the coolant rings had to be was inverted. It was they had the wrong null hypothesis, and so they ended up passing on the mechanical check of all the pieces of the Challenger module, and then it ended up, I guess it wasn't a module, but anyway, that explosion was actually as a result of a misplaced null hypothesis. So they're not all created equal.
I want to turn it personal to Randy again. You ready?
Okay.
You brace for it? Because you did say when you were talking about the afterlife, you go, I will say that I know for sure that the Mormon heaven is not true, incorrect, absolute.
Doesn't exist.
Doesn't exist.
Yeah. And or heaven does – if there's an afterlife, it doesn't exist in the form that Mormonism presents. And if you're just an outsider and you look at everything that there is to know about the history of the church, the disconfirming, the preponderance of disconfirming evidence against its claims, it's not even a discussion. The only way is if you're from the inside and you've built a super strong emotional attachment to it that, you know, you can even give it a chance. And I'm not talking about seeing, you know, coming across missionaries and really feeling like you feel connected to these people and this could be a good place for you. I'm talking about a cold analysis from an outsider that has never heard of Mormonism. And then you present it and it's so laughable.
Right. And I like I'm struggling to even think of, like, if you put a probability percentage, what percentage that might be, you know, that still left a little bit of a, you know, Jim Carrey Dumb and Dumber door open.
So you're telling me there's a
chance. Right, yeah, yeah. You know. But, like, I think if you make a claim about the Book of Mormon not being true, I think that's easier to prove.
Oh, yeah.
Than, like, when you get into the metaphysical realm. Because if there is something, even if somebody's a totally non-credible source, they could guess it right.
Well, yeah, that's part of the logical fallacy of, you know, the genetic fallacy. You know, you dismiss an argument or evidence because of the source.
Yeah.
Well,
but isn't that still, on aggregate,
I still think it's an interesting choice for you, Randy, when, like, that you continually. Do, like, you'll be having a conversation, then as an aside, you'll go, and we know, of course, the Book of Mormon's not true. And, you know, oh, and we know, of course, that Mormon heaven's not true. You know, that's part of your tribe. Personality. That's
my tribe.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm pretty close on Jesus.
What does that mean?
That he didn't get resurrected, and he's not the creator of the universe.
Oh, okay.
But Mormonism is just so cartoonishly silly to me, and it was my tribe for so long. I'm always going to talk about Mormonism.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so this is where I think this is where the connection is different between people that are
truth-seeking
or not truth-seekers. No, but yeah. I think this is where the conversation – this is where we're talking past each other, because I agree that if you evaluate the Book of Mormon purely as whether or not it's a historical record that occurred in the Americas, if you approach that question with only those parameters, narrowly defined like that, absolutely you can put a huge preponderance of evidence on the side of not a historical record.
Any tool in
but the implication of that and what direction that implication flows in, that determines how people react to it. So the implication of that from you know, a naturalist empiricist would be, well, it's not, you know, Mormonism is not true, or, you know, this book has no spiritual value because it's not what it claims to be empirically. But I think that somebody viewing it from a non-empirical truth lens would say, well, the gaps that we see in the empirical side.
I'm a little confused. I need to recalibrate. Do you mean non-empirical truth, or do you mean non-naturalist empiricist?
I would say I don't know. I don't know which of those. Let's say non-naturalist empiricist, for example.
Okay, they are an empiricist, but they accept the metaphysics.
They accept the metaphysics, and they prioritize the metaphysics over the naturalistic side. So those people, if you view Mormonism from that sense, from that lens, then they're going to say, well, the gaps that we see in the empirical side can be suspended because I've already accepted the metaphysical truth, and the empirical truth is subservient to the metaphysical truth of this book. And that's where you get crazy apologetics and weird mental gymnastics. That's where that comes from. Is they're trying to fill those gaps because they're prioritizing metaphysical quote unquote truth over the empirical side of it.
Would you call that a null hypothesis that was fostered in that metaphysical environment in the church? And so their default position is it's impossible to empirically prove the absence of God, or you can't prove that the celestial kingdom doesn't exist. So I'm gonna say that it's there and dare you to prove me wrong. Kind of argument from
ignorance.
Right, right. I mean, there are logical fallacies.
Yeah. Point for Randy.
Right. But yeah, I would say that a good way of putting it would be that they, you know, they have a metaphysically fostered null hypothesis of the way that they view.
They're begging the question. The answer is in their premise. It's already there. The metaphysical world is true, and I'm going to work back from that.
Right.
And it's not the way that
history has gotten to where we are today.
Right, right. I don't think that it's a good. I don't think it's a very constructive mentality. But
yeah, they're doing it wrong. Remember, Glenn, what I said to you in Newark?
Oh, about rock. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say. But I wouldn't say that they're not truth seekers. That's what I would. That's what I would. I mean, if we can come back to that, I wouldn't say that they're not truth seekers.
But they have an aversion to accept uncomfortable, contradicting evidence to their what makes them what they've already presupposed that makes them feel
because
happy.
They've already defined what truth is, and they keep seeking after that, so it just reinforces and reinforces and reinforces and reinforces, because they are within that box, within, you know, you talked about staying inside the confines of your own house as a metaphor there, but they think they've already found the truth. And I think it's that they're not interested in naturalism. Yeah,
that's a different definition of truth, because it's not really the kind of truth I'm talking about. I'm talking about the stuff that you can
naturalistic empirical truth.
Confirm.
Yeah.
That,
right.
You know.
But I think this is where Jake's distinction on empiricism helps to bridge the gap, because these people are not naturalists, even if they're empiricists. And their null hypothesis is on the supernatural. And so they're not interested in rejecting the supernatural.
Yeah. Right.
We don't have to equivocate to say, like, oh, they're just the same. I think that naturalist empiricism is better. I do.
Right.
I think that's better than not doing that. But from their – I can see how from their perspective – they think they are being, you know, this is that they are being truth seekers, and they're not just trying to be comfortable or sit around.
Okay. So, what do you guys think is the difference? And it's oversimplifying it to come up with just a difference, because the human brain is so complex and there's so many environmental things going on in everyone's lives. But, you know, what do you think is the difference between the people that chose to, and I don't even know if they chose, that ended up going the very uncomfortable route, the painful route of admitting they've been wrong for decades, you know, absolutely wrong for decades, and leaving the Mormon church, versus the people that no matter how much information you present them, they're just not going to accept it. You don't think there's a different personality difference or some kind of difference in their brain?
I mean, that assertion makes me uncomfortable, and I don't know.
I mean, for me, I would say that...
What assertion? I asked a question.
The assertion that they have different types of brains, that there is like a type that does and a type that doesn't.
That, like, or like some,
when,
not,
you get,
or
when you get to
inside.
Brain type, because like what I would expect if I looked into this, I would expect to see, yes, of course there are different types of brains, but for every type of brain, you would find some that are still in the church and some that are out of the church, and they've got the same type of brain.
Well, that's kind of an assertion.
Yeah, but that's one I'm much more comfortable with than to say everybody that has this type of brain has left the church or will leave the church.
How about has a higher propensity? Because there's also environmental factors at work. Like in the 1960s, you didn't have access to any information.
Yeah.
If you wanted to get this confirming information, you had to go to like the University of Utah library and then find the right floor, then find the right aisle, then find the right shelf, and then pull off a dusty book. I'm fascinated by the phenomenon that I see.
I don't understand well enough what you mean by type of brain, I think. I think that that's where I'm uncomfortable. I just don't really know what that means.
Okay. Well, I guess it's just too difficult of a question to ask because it's too complex. But I think it's interesting that some people... there's probably another thing that's at work. There, in my opinion, there's got to be some kind of emotional breaking point where, because your average TBM, the question is, if you ask them the question, is it possible the church isn't true? That's like an incoherent question. They can't even, there's nowhere to go with that because they have such a strong presupposition that does not compute. But at some point, you do have to come to the place where you do ask the question in your mind, is it possible the church is not true? And so I think
something has to break inside that emotional part of the brain before you're going to allow the rational part to process any kind of disconfirming information. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I mean, that was the case with me. It took there is some it wasn't until I felt at odds with the culture and my emotional experience within the church and like the fit of just the whole Mormon mold. And it wasn't until I felt like I wasn't fitting in there that I had that dissonance that I was willing to reverse that null hypothesis and view it from the other side of, okay, let's assume it's not true and work and see if it still holds up, you know, as I evaluate this stuff. And then, you know, things started falling apart. So I think that, you know, there does need to be some sort of emotional break at some point. And a lot of that happens. That's why people are so disillusioned by this, by a lot of this information. A lot of times the emotional break is learning about things that you didn't know were the case, like the head in the hat. Like, I don't know how the head in the hat is any weirder than magic glasses or whatever, right? I mean, it's empirically, it seems like they're both very fantastical, crazy stories.
The way that Joseph Smith translated the Book of Mormon.
Right. Yes, that's what I mean. Sorry. But yeah.
That's for our 5 non-Mormon listeners out there.
Right. There you go. There you go. Still thinking about you. But when you learn about the head in the hat, a lot of times that's the emotional break for people, because the disillusionment, there's kind of this latent embarrassment of the people that knew about it, but they didn't. You know, people that were that were really insulted by the South Park episode and then learned that that was more factually accurate than every depiction they'd heard this scene in church. That sometimes is the emotional break. But the thing is, I think
it's like a betrayal. They're like,
yeah,
that's what causes the emotional break.
So I think that's what these essays are trying to do. I think the whole idea of inoculation is to try and preempt that at least that flavor of emotional break.
I had like this cascade of coming across things that bothered me, but the environment that they came in was really important. So I still remember the first time I heard about Blacks in the Priesthood. And that bugged me and made me kind of angry that I had to defend it, but I learned it in church, or I learned it in my home. Then I remember.
How old were you?
I don't remember.
Pre-mission, post-mission?
Oh, pre-priesthood.
Pre-priesthood. And it bothered you then?
Uh-huh. I had seen Roots and early on in my life, I was a very connected, at least emotionally connected to the civil rights movement. And then I found out my own damn church didn't let people have the priesthood until like 4 years earlier.
Giving that example helps me understand the different types of brain a little bit, because, you know, like saying that you're wired more towards that type of empathy than I am. I don't want to say what I am. But like, yeah. I didn't have that sense of feeling until much later, and I think even then it wasn't like emotional disgust that I felt for it. I just like went, oh, that's actually doesn't make sense. You know, it's kind of more of a, I don't know,
more of a just detached analysis.
I'm really detached in a lot of ways. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So then I learned about polygamy when I was about 12 or 13 in the cultural hall, when somebody told me, you know, Brigham had 50 wives. And I'm like, yeah, but he probably didn't, he probably was only, you know, had kids with his first wife. No, he had 100 kids.
Yeah.
that kind of caused an emotional break, but I'd learned in church, and people were there to reinforce that it's okay. And then I go to BYU and I take this awesome religion class on Mormon on church history, and this rogue guy tells me about the hat, the stone in the hat. He tells me about Fanny Alger. He tells me about the papyrus being found. You know, all these things that had come out in the Leonard and Arrington era. But then I was in at BYU, and he bore his testimony after explaining each one, gave something plausible. But each one was kind of another emotional break. And then from that time to the time
when I found out about polyandry. Well, I found out about polyandry reading something in my house. And that was, whoosh, the emotion to the church was gone. And it wasn't long after that before, you know, the last straw was Prop 8. And I was gone. Hmm. So inoculation, I think there is something to it, but it still goes back to that. You have to at least loosen the grip that your brain, your emotional brain has to this wonderful notion, this wonderful institution that has all the answers and gives you this comfort of what's to come in the next life. Takes away the, you know, staring into the abyss that atheists have to do.
Yeah, this interests me to find out more. I mean, I'm pretty lazy, so I probably won't. But to find out more about these brain types that you're talking about, because I you're talking about the way that you responded. The way I responded was very different. I don't know.
Yeah, I grew up on a right next to the Navajo Indian Reservation, so I was really used to racism because we grew up like these are the Lamanites, and this idea of the Lamanites and the dark skin and being cursed for that just never really bothered me. And plus, I didn't know any black people because I was in in Sheola, Arizona. So I'm like, you never really have to confront it. So
yeah, I spent 4 months in Sheola on my mission. It's pretty. It's pretty snow white, pretty ivory.
Right. Delightsome, I would say.
What was the deal with all the old guys saying, "Dad gum ding-a-ling, that dad gum ding-a-ling"? I heard that so much in Sholo.
I don't remember. That doesn't stick out to me. But I haven't been there. I mean, I haven't lived there since I was, in 10 years. So
there was this one guy in our ward. So funny. He was like, this total salty old man, and he cussed all the time, but he had a really good heart. And the guy was excommunicated years ago, and he was totally active in the ward. And it's like, why won't you get rebaptized? Never could figure out. Did you know that guy at all, or I'm just shooting? I'm shooting in the dark. This guy was kind of a prominent figure in the ward, so I was taking a shot that you were in one of the wards. Dude, do you know how big Sholo is back then, Glenn?
It's pretty small. I mean, it was like 5,000 people.
No, 5,000 people.
It's just funny. It's like, oh yeah, I know that. Do you know that guy? It's just
I wanted him to go, oh, that's brother, and that would have been so cool because I forgot his name.
Right, but sorry. I remember when you were hoping that Jake's dad was the brother Frost that you remembered, and it wasn't
the guy who,
so.
Yeah, he's the one who taught me how to lasso.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it wasn't him. No. Dang it.
I know. But you were, let's see, how old were you in 90, in early 94? First 4 months in 94.
4 years old.
My God.
Yeah. So you don't remember that old guy in the ward that had been excommunicated but was still totally active?
Yeah, he probably died before you ever
Right.
<him.
laughs>
Yeah. Do you remember, like, this is moving completely off track now, but I'm waxing nostalgic for Arizona folklore. Did either of you guys hear the one about the saguaro cactuses? Like every place that there's a saguaro cactus, that's where an Indian died.
Oh,
and the number of arms that the saguaro cactus has is the number of wives that Indian had. And if the arm goes up, it was a good wife, and if it goes down, it was a bad wife. Did either of you guys hear that?
No, I never heard that. Yeah. That's great, though. Yeah. That is hilarious.
I'll be interested with our Arizona listeners if this kid makes it. I don't know.
Right.
The other one that I just like, I grew up hearing things like that and going, oh, that's cool. Like, I don't know at what point I went, okay, that's just a story. But because growing up, I thought, okay, well, that means Lamanites, and that means the Lamanites must have practiced polygamy. So when I hear about Mormons practicing polygamy. It's like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a restoration of all things. Because the Saguaros had multiple arms on the trees. Of course.
Of course the Lamanites practice polygamy.
Yeah. And of course, it's this totally masculine world where you don't have any female Indians that are like, I don't know, maybe those are the Choya, the jumping cactus. I don't know. What are they? But they're just arms on the male Saguaro cactus. The other one I loved was the story about Camelback Mountain. You guys hear that? The princess, and she's going through the desert, and she's got this camel that's totally faithful and loves her, and she says, all right, wait here, I'll be right back. And she goes to find her prince or whatever it is, and she never comes back, but the camel just kept waiting. Just kept waiting and waiting.
Because
he
understood her message. I'll be back.
Yeah. I'll be back. And the mountain formed around the camel. But, you know, still to this day, the camel's there waiting for the princess. I don't know. That's not really Sholo area. Do you know what Camelback Mountain is, Jake?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've been hiking on Camelback Mountain, I think.
Yeah. So, little things like that I heard when I was growing up that I think they were kind of formative in certain ways, but yeah.
You had to know the McNeil family. They had like 13 kids, and the dad had one arm.
Oh yeah!
Yay! I got a hit.
Hi, this is Todd from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I love driving to work because I listen to Infants on Thrones on my commute. You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com, and if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
If I only had...
Thank you for listening to
Infants on Thrones!
Infants on Thrones.
A brain...
really creamy shit coming out of somebody's ass.